right. This is Pure Decking for Thursday, March the 7th, 2013. This is a show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps. Tonight we have Foxard and Suave. So I'm on my second shot of cold, of traditional cold medicine. So what are you guys on to?
I'm drinking still that Captain Morgan's private stock.
Nice.
Rum and Coke.
Rum and Coke, very cool. Fox said he'd be in and out at the start, so I don't know.
No, I'm back. I was at least here for the booze portion. I mean, come on, man. I've got priorities.
Yeah. Most important part of the show.
Yeah, so I've got 12-year Dalmore scotch.
Ooh, very nice. Very nice. So, I am sorry about missing the show last week, but my voice was fucked, and I was pretty well sick, so... I missed a couple days of work too, so I'm still on the tail end of it, but I would rather miss a show than do one that's really just going to be shit, like on purpose. I mean, we all have shows that are going to be shit, but I'd rather not do it on purpose. So, I got a lot of story suggestions for the show I missed and immediately afterwards, but, that's just kind of the way it played out. So sorry about that, guys. Anyways, moving straight in, myself and several others have recently gotten our hands on Raspberry Pis, so I thought we'd have some fun discussing those. So, Suave, I know you picked one up.
Yep.
Sard, Fox, either of you pick up one of those?
I have not. I actually kind of wanted to talk to you guys before I thought about picking one up, so this will be a good topic for me to...
Cool. So I haven't done too much with mine yet. I've of course tried a couple of different distros for it, got it up and running, but I really haven't had too much time to really mess with it. I've got an idea of what I'm going to do with it though. But Suave, what have you been doing with yours?
Not a whole lot. I'm going pretty much the opposite route of you, where I have no idea what I wanted to do with mine, and I figured I'd get it and just kind of jump off the deep end and go from there.
So you just had money burning a hole in your pocket, and you're like, I'll buy that.
Well, when you say money burning a hole in your pocket, $35 isn't really a huge drop in that bucket there. And that's one of the really cool things about the Raspberry Pi. It's just so cheap. Like, it's almost disposable. You know, don't buy coffee for a month and you've paid for one. Not even,
but,
like...
Yeah, but coffee?
And actually, they even have a cheaper model. I think it's the A model. It's $25, and it's, I believe, just has some a little bit less RAM.
Yeah. Actually, I don't think it has the Ethernet port, too.
Oh, okay, that's what it is. Yeah.
But, I think it's only got one USB port as well, but who cares? You got to use a hub anyways.
Yeah. First thing I did, of course, was like, I got to put it in some sort of case. So I went and manufactured a little cardboard box for it
until I can whip out my printer. I've been keeping mine in just an extra plastic box I had kicking around. I don't really have a case for it yet. I'm probably gonna fold some Lexan and make a case for it. But
that's a good idea.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
I was actually kind of shocked to hear, like, Suave's like, you've got a 3D printer. Why the fuck are you putting this thing in a cardboard box?
Well, no. I actually am working on a case for it, but like, I kind of want to figure out what I'm going to use it for before I print the case, because if I'm going to use it for a wearable computer, I'm going to want to put like attachment points and stuff like that to, like, maybe clip onto my bag or whatever. Depending on what I'm going to use it for, the case is actually going to be different. So right now it's just in a temporary cardboard box until I actually figure out what I'm doing with it. I am kind of keen on making a wearable computer, just because, it's tiny, it takes very little power. You can power it with easily, like very simply with a USB battery pack. It has like a RCA video out that works perfectly with that MyView crystal that I've hacked into a monocle.
Do you actually get readable text off that thing?
Yeah. You've got to set it to a 640 by 480 resolution,
So you get like 4 lines of readable text, but you get readable.
Oh, come on, 640 by 480 isn't that bad. Like I remember when I was like, working on computers back in the day, like that was pretty much standard for computer monitors.
Okay, it's grandma's resolutions.
And anything you're doing on the Raspberry Pi, you know, it's not like a beefy setup. So, you know, having a lower resolution is actually better because it's going to increase your performance.
Okay. Every time I've ever messed with RCA outs, I've admittedly not played with the RCA out or MyView Crystal, but on mine. But every time I've messed with a computer, even low res going through over an RCA, it's always been fuzzed up. I mean, it's always been.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's not perfect, but, you know, I had that MyView Crystal set up with the. I had an Acer Aspire 1 that it was hooked up to, and I had that hacked down to 640 by 480, and all the text was totally readable. And, you know, like it's not like perfectly crisp, but it's right. Still like there's very minimal issues with it. And really, for like a wearable type display, it's not something that you're going to be staring at all the time or anything either.
Yeah.
Or just like see, a reference.
I've got parts to an old 3D headset that I tore down years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept intending to get back to the thing and turn it into something useful. I actually wanted to put it in some welding goggles, but I've just never got back to it, and it's just not been a priority. But I keep thinking one of those would be fun for a wearable, and the Raspberry might be a good way to go on that. But I know that when I was messing with it, even over that thing actually had a VGA hookup, and it's
oh, okay.
It had a gimbal in it. If you had the drivers for it, you could actually get it to do the head tracking. But it was pretty pathetic. I'm really blanking on the name of the thing though, and I don't have the case anymore because that's all in the trash. All I kept was the circuit and the screens, but and the power supply thing. But it's one of those old ass arcade 3D headsets. A buddy of mine gave it to me. I don't even remember where he scavenged it from.
Right. But
it was like missing a lens and all this other crazy ass stuff. So I thought I'd tear it down and start it fresh, but. Never got back to it, so the whole wearable thing just kind of, I lost track of it. It's like I can just look down at my cell phone, it doesn't bother me that much.
Well, yeah, you know, to be fair, you know, wearable computer is kind of redundant at this point in time if you have a smartphone. Because really, like, the smartphone is more convenient. But, you know, there is something to be said for just, like, the awesome aspect of having this fucking wearable display. And you know, there are some uses to it, like, you know, let's say you're doing trying to do art or something like that in Photoshop. It'd be nice to have like this little kind of display, let's say, that actually shows you like a reference image or something like that, so you
all,
can kind of glance up at it. Or
computer, all I would want out of a wearable computer is a heads-up display. So that, you know, it's like running around in a shooter where you got the little waypoint telling you which direction to go, and you got something telling you how many hit points you have left, and how it determines that, that'd be a real treat. But it's like you put it on and you see you're at 65. It's like, oh, God, what the hell? It's like, yep, you're going to have a heart attack. Damn it.
You know, that actually would add a lot of difficulty with the Raspberry Pi in regards to actually tracking the direction you're facing, as well as GPS and all that other sort of stuff. So like, you're going to be pretty limited to just like displaying something. It's probably not going to be very locationally aware.
Yeah, and that, again, that's where your smartphone seems to win.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, exactly. So, you know, like I say, it's not the most practical thing, but it's still awesome.
Well, it's just that's the wearable's cool. But most of the variations I see, like when you go online and looking at what other people are doing with Raspberry Pis, they're all variations on just a small desktop PC. Like, you know, they're an XBMC box, or which Analog tried that and said he didn't like it. So I haven't played with it yet.
I tried their Android port, and that was pretty much garbage as well. So I'm not a big fan of XBMC.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are using them for like little experimentation computers, or even as desktop replacements, or various servers. Which, I mean, it's all like for the processing power. Yeah, it's kind of cool to do it with the Raspberry Pi, but I mean, you might as well just grab an old laptop or something, right?
Well, yeah, but like, you know, you got to remember the price point too. So like, the ability to have a desktop computer for $35, like, yeah, it's not the best system or anything like that, but you know, it's $35. Who cares? You know, there is that aspect to it. So I understand people buying it for that reason. There's not anything cheaper out there really for that same sort of use.
Well, that's true.
And you know, on the plus side, you have all these people now, and now they've got this device that has these great input-output pins for all kinds of different projects. And, you know, like now that they've got it, they might decide, oh, well, you know, what else can I do with this? Because, you know, it doesn't actually work that well as a desktop. It's kind of slow. And they might start doing other things. So, you know, like you might knock them going and just like turning it into a desktop right now, but it might actually turn them on to doing other things.
I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying I don't think that it's the best solution for that.
Fair enough.
But, you know, you do see, because of its size, you do see some interesting ideas, like people setting up to be a, like you mentioned, because of the price point, it's practically disposable.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of different guides out there for setting them up as a pen testing box, you know, yeah, like a little miniature backtrack distro. And the idea being, you know, you cover the thing in electrical tape and hide it in something and just go leave it in your Mark's network. So you've got an access point to get back in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have it beacon out on I2P or something. Iron Geek, I don't have a link for it, but Iron Geek did a project called the Slarpfast? Slarp? It was some word I don't know how to say. And the idea was he was using a Pogo plug at the time, but he was talking about redoing it when the Raspberry Pis came out, and I forgot to go back and check on it, and he's probably forgotten about it too. But the idea was that you would leave this thing in somebody else's network, and it would beacon out on I2P, so you could connect to it and then have a machine inside somebody else's network for pen testing. So I've seen a couple of write-ups on using the Raspberry Pi for that, which I thought was pretty interesting. But
makes
I don't
a
know.
Lot of sense. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, $35 isn't too much of an investment. I mean, you're not going to be leaving them all over the place. But
$25 if you want to go for the lower end one.
Yeah, really.
Well, if all you need is just something to bounce off of, like, you know, SSH into it and funnel traffic out, then yeah, it's great.
Yeah, pivot point.
Definitely. But I don't know. See, you know, you mentioned the GPIO pins on it, so I know a lot of people look at it and see small computer. I look at it and I see a big Arduino. it's got GPIOs. It's, you know, fairly decent processor. And so I see it as an Arduino running a Linux stack, not a small PC.
Why not both?
Well, that's true.
You know, like I saw one guy, he did a project in his car where he wanted a car computer setup. So he had like a, you know, the 7-inch LCD screen mounted in his dash. He had a Raspberry Pi, and he used the GPIO pins to read the diagnostic port. Like it would query it every couple of seconds, and it would get all kinds of data, like fuel efficiency, and like he was actually setting it up to like do a cost per trip. So, you know, from the time you turn on the engine to the time you turn it off, it'll actually take into account gas, local gas prices and all this other stuff.
Oh, I don't think I would like, want that online.
Well,
it'd be like,
know,
okay,
I'm
I can't
just
leave
saying,
the
though,
house
but, like,
ever.
This is the sort of capability that you have when you actually start having these, really working with these GPIO pins. So it, like, yeah, he's using it as the car computer, but he's using it as a lot more than just that.
Yeah,
it's got a lot of capability.
So, but I do see a lot of these things ending up being 3D printer controllers for one thing, because it'd be very easy to turn one of these into a driver for something like a 3D printer or a plotter or a milling station, stuff like that. But the idea I've got for mine, I think is pretty fun. I have a DirecTV satellite dish a friend of mine gave me a while back, and for a little while I had a high power Wi-Fi card zip tied into it and some aluminum foil to direct it, and so I've been meaning to tear the thing down and do a better build of an antenna, actually build the bow tie antenna, mount it in there correctly, cut a little bit of plywood to, you know, really get a good angle on it and really, really dial this thing in so it's a good directional high power Wi-Fi antenna, right? And then I'm going to get some bearings, and I'm going to see if I can't build a directional Wi-Fi controller out of the Raspberry Pi. Have the Raspberry run the Wi-Fi card, and use some of the GPIO pins to drive some servos so that you could basically open this thing up, set it down, and either over the network or maybe, you know, however you want to control it, remote into the thing, tell it where to point the directional antenna, you know, give it some degrees, and then be able to do whatever you need to do with a directional high-power Wi-Fi antenna.
That's a cool idea.
So that's, I'm actually going to see if I can't steal the servos out of an old USB missile launcher, because they should be a decent voltage for the Raspi to drive. So that means I'm going to have to gear and balance this thing really well, because the servos aren't going to be very strong. But they shouldn't have to be if I can get the weight balanced correctly. And the thing's not that heavy. So, but it'll be something if I get it working right, because I'll be able to like just put it up in the attic and give it a direction and go nuts, right?
Yeah, man, that's a great idea. That's cool.
Oh, absolutely.
But that's what I got envisioned for mine, but I don't know that that's, you know, the final project it'll end up in. Because I'm not gonna hard solder anything with the board. I'm gonna make a header, probably out of an old IDE cable that I can plug into the GPIO slot on the Raspi. So if I decide I want to yank it and use it in something else, I gotta do swaps. That's the one thing I really like about the Raspi. It's all on an SD card. So if you want to pull it out and use it for a different project, if you haven't gone nuts with the soldering iron on the damn thing, and you know you do your casing correctly, you can just pull it out of one project and leave the SD card with the other project, put a different SD card in it and swap the machine in, do whatever, and then if you decide you need to, of course it's cheap enough, you just buy another one. But you know, for just testing something out, you can just yank it out and you don't even mess up your old project. You just, you know, leave the SD card with the other project and use a fresh one. Because a 4 gig SD card didn't cost much. So,
you know, when you mentioned using a Raspberry Pi with 3D printers and stuff like that, it's funny because also because you mentioned people just like using it as a PC. I was looking into using a Raspberry Pi to run a 3D printer and stuff like that, and the majority of the links that I found were people who were basically just using the Raspberry Pi to feed the like model data to the 3D printer, which already had like all its circuitry and everything like that, which would then in turn run the servos and everything like that.
Oh, so they were just hooking it straight up to like a MakerBot and then feeding it over the network. So
they weren't using it to build a 3D printer. They were just using it instead of a computer to feed the data to the 3D printer. And they're like, ooh, look, I'm running my printer with the Raspberry Pi. Ooh, no, that's not what that means.
Fair point. I think we found a nerve.
It was a little frustrating trying to find information on doing it, because there's too many dumbasses doing that.
I understand that. So, I don't know. Sard, did that kind of help you out any with the idea for this thing? I mean, it's not like, you know, you buy it to play with another computer. This is more, you know, kind of a project thing.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it's not something easy to get into. Like, personally, I don't have a lot of experience with hardware or anything like that, so I really have no fucking clue what I'm doing. But I feel like it's definitely good for learning, because you do have it's really easy to get up and running. You have a lot of different options and stuff like that to actually experiment with.
I just like an Arduino that you can SSH into and, you know, rewrite your Python code right on the device.
Yeah,
don't have to flash it, and you know, I'm a lot more familiar with Python than I am, you know, Arduino C. So I don't have a problem with Arduino C. I just don't do it nearly as often. So, but
I think it'd be something neat and fun to play around with. Like, that was one question I had asked you guys earlier. You know, is like, for people that don't know, like, what language do you have to use? What's the programming environment? Well,
would they recommend Python? But it's a full Linux stack. You can use C, C++, Java.
Yeah, well, don't they have full Linux distros in it? So, I mean, can you literally just load
it's
Linux on
Raspbian
it and do whatever?
Is Debian.
Yeah, okay. Like I've got it installed on my Raspberry Pi right now, and yeah, it's a Linux. It's a full Linux distro essentially.
Cool. Yeah, they're using LXDE desktop environment and just a very minimal Debian install. I know Fedora has a spin for it. Okay. There's Plan 9, I think, has a spin for it.
That makes a lot more sense then, because you could load any Linux distro on there and then have all of your normal Linux tools at your fingertips on a
computer. Any Linux distro that'll run on an ARM chip, like Debian, yeah. Fedora, Arch. Arch is the one I was trying to think of. There's another OS, Risk. Risk OS is... I haven't played with that one yet. I've been meaning to play with that one. But yeah, there's the Risk OS too. That's another big one. There is an Android port, but apparently it's not very good. Everything I've read on it is nothing but people having problems with it. So, but
well, that's neat, man. Like I said, I mean, you have your full set of tools essentially there that you can use on it. You're really only limited to what you can think of it. And the I/O, having I/O pins like directly on it, that's pretty cool too for doing programming. I mean, that would be kind of neat, I think, to play with. And like you said, you don't have to flash it like
Arduino
basic stamp. That's what I played
stamps,
before.
Oh, stamps, yeah.
Yeah, you know, well, and you have to have the USB to a whatever adapter, and I don't know. It's
those
neat.
Stamps you got
to
have a programming kit for those. The thing about the stamp that was annoying was the chip might be, you know, $4. The programmer was like $300.
Yeah.
So that one was a little bit rough to get into. I think they've gotten better about that now, but it was just like, are you serious? Actually, though, speaking of Android on these things, when I ordered the Raspi, I also ordered one of those Android, like, mini PC on a sticks. I don't know if you guys have seen those.
Oh, yeah.
I know Suave has. Sard, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that run Android. They're, like said, mini PCs with, like, an HDMI out on them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's about the size of two or three decent-sized flash drives kind of sandwiched together.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those run, what, like 50 to 75 bucks, something like that?
I got mine for about 35, so it was one of the lower-end ones. Since I'm starting to play with Android development, I was thinking it'd just be a beater box, you know, something I can crash a lot and not be terribly upset about it. And I was not giving this thing proper credit, even though it's a lower-spec one. I mean, I was goofing around with it on my TV. It ran Netflix fine. I looked like a cell phone resolution stretched up to a TV, but it was running it fine.
That's neat, so, but I mean, cell phone resolution, like that, I don't know.
Well, that was, I think, it was trying to run a cell phone version of Netflix, but it sets itself up to look like a tablet. You plug keyboard and mouse into it, and you just use it like an Android tablet.
Huh.
So, or like if you've ever put Android on a netbook, kind of felt like using that. So.
And that's probably more of a Netflix limitation than the actual hardware limitation.
I don't know. I know it ran Angry Birds fine. I mean, absolutely fine. I mean, I was just goofing around with it. I haven't really put it through its paces. But I was really pleasantly surprised that the thing was performing as well as it did. So I'm going to have to see about rooting it and finding a ROM for it, which, right. But, I mean... You know, just as kind of a beater box, it's certainly going to do that purpose. But I could see one of the higher end of these little Android PC on sticks being a very serviceable media PC.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think the fastest one I've seen now is like a dual core 1.8 gigahertz. I think it was 2 gigs of RAM. And then, you know, yeah, that's more than you need for a media setup.
Now, the annoying thing on it is I'll have to, if I wanted to do something with it a little bit less, you know, a little bit more like the Raspi, it doesn't have any of the GPIO pins. You'd have to get one of those USB adapters and hook it up to an Arduino, probably.
Well, that's the thing about those. Hey, they've got very, very limited ports.
It's got like one USB
HDMI
port.
And one USB. That's it.
Yep. Yeah, that's it. So
like that is extremely limited. So you know, for something like that, your best bet is to use it with a TV and get one of those little mouse keyboard combination feels that just has a USB.
I was just using my I've got a Logitech keyboard that instead of a number pad has a touch pad.
Oh, perfect.
And that's what I use for the PC. I use for my my home theater PC.
Right.
And so I was just stealing the connections from that and hooking it up to this little Android stick to play with it. And like I said, I was surprised. It did better than I was expecting because I was looking at the stats on it. And it's like, yeah, I knew it wasn't that great when I ordered it. But I'm surprised at how well it was doing. I mean, it's running an Android 4.0, so...
Yeah,
I'd like it to run, 4.2, but I'm not going to hold my breath for it. But it'd be
I
nice to get.
I think there are some out there that will run that.
Well, it's more. Is there a ROM for it? Jailbreak it? Can I find like a Cyanogen for it? And I don't see these kind of things having that kind of support.
Well, it depends. Like, there's actually a couple of models out there. I think it's like the MK802 or something like that. That actually it seems to be the one that the community is getting behind.
I see.
So like there are some models out there that seem like you're going to have a much better chance of actually finding community support versus some of like the more generic no-name versions, because there's a ton of different models out there now. But a lot of them use the same chipset, so you might actually get away with using that same. If somebody comes out with a ROM for one version, it'll work with another.
I hadn't thought about that. It might be worth cracking the case on the thing open just so I can see what chipset's actually in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
See if it's got a JTAG port or something.
There's generally there's not a lot of different chipsets out there. It's just people are rebranding it, putting it in different cases, and selling it as their own product. So yeah, it definitely would be worth your while to check that out.
It might be fun to see if I can pull apart an old laptop and replace its brains with the Android stick.
Yeah,
that'd be kind of fun.
I don't know. I'll get some ideas there, but that's. Overkill, really. The other thing I thought I might do with the Raspi is I've got a busted Commodore 64.
Yeah.
I was going to be fun to use the GPIO pins to use the C64's keyboard and just stick the Raspi in it and hook it up. But I'm probably not going to do that just because I like the Wi-Fi antenna idea much better.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I just realized.
I just realized
we're half an hour into the show here. So, oops.
Portable computing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just like when we get going on cell phones too. It's like we do half the damn show, and then we're like, "Ooh, we haven't done any news yet." So, I wasn't expecting to get to Digital Dojo tonight, anyways. To be honest, so just go right into it. Here are some current events. First one up is from BGR, and. This is kind of cool. Just one day after the White House got behind efforts making unlocking cell phones legal again, Senator Amy Klobuchar? I don't mean to butcher her name. I have no idea how to say that. Vowed to introduce a bill this week that will get rid of the ban on unlocking cell phones. Both Amy and the White House were responding directly to an online petition that urged the government to reverse the decision made by the Librarian of Congress last fall to deny consumers the right to unlock their cell phones and bring them to different carriers. In announcing her new legislation, Amy said that the consumers should be free to choose the phone and service that best fits their needs and budgets, and that we need to make sure consumers are getting a fair deal, and today's announcement is a welcome step towards implementing consumer-friendly policies in the wireless industry. So in other words, the government is actually being kind enough to acknowledge that your property is in fact yours.
Imagine that.
Wow.
What a surprise. Like, logical.
How nice
of them. That's
them.
Bizarre.
I'm so grateful that they're making sure that the things that we own belong to us. Thank you.
Well, I can understand the argument for keeping a cell phone locked while it's in that initial contract because they're, really subsidizing the cost of the phone.
The early termination fees for.
Well, I know. But, I can understand the logic of that argument. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I'm saying I can understand it. Certainly, when it's out of that first contract, you ought to be able to do whatever the hell you want with it. At that point, it's your hardware.
You know, like you should have either an early termination fee or have, you know, hardware locked phones to carriers. You can't have both. You know, that's like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree. I'm just saying I can see the logic of the other side of the argument. So, but either way, when that first contract's up, you ought to be able to do whatever the hell you want with that phone.
Oh yeah.
So
absolutely.
You know, and, you know, whether the contract's up early because you paid the fee or it's up because you paid your 2 years, that it is your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to do whatever the hell you want with it. But, so yeah, I kind of like that they had to introduce a law to say, no, your property is in fact yours. So, but, you know, such is the nature of the DMCA. Next one up, this one is from the BBC. Android, this is hilarious. Android's data scrambling system was good enough for end users, but a nightmare for law enforcement and forensics workers. The team at Erlangen's Frederick Alexander University wrote in a blog post about their work. To get around this, researchers Tilo Mueller, Michael Spritzenbarth, and Felix Frelling from FAU put Android phones in a freezer for an hour until the device had cooled below 10 degrees Celsius. The trio discovered that quickly connecting and disconnecting the battery of a frozen phone forced the handset into a vulnerable mode. This loophole let them start it up with some custom-built software rather than its onboard Android operating system. Isn't it easier just to hold down the, was it volume down on the home button to get it into? Anyways, the researchers dubbed their custom code Frost, Forensic Recovery of Scrambled Telephones. The Frost software helped them to copy data on a phone that could then be analyzed on a separate computer. A chilled phone also helped their hacking project. Data fades from memory much more slowly when the chips are cold, which allowed them to grab the encryption keys and speed up the unscrambling of the contents of the phone. PhD student Tilo Mueller told the BBC that the attack generally gave them access to data that had been put into memory as users browsed websites, sent messages, or shared pictures. The researchers tested their attack against the Samsung Galaxy Nexus handset, as it was one of the first to use Android's disk encryption system. So, yeah, most of the older devices aren't even bothering to encrypt the disk.
Wow. However,
they said, other phones were just as likely to be vulnerable to attack. The team are planning further tests on other Android handsets. While the cold boot attack has been tried on desktop PCs and laptops, Mr. Mueller said the trio were the first to try it on phones. We thought it would work because smartphones are really small PCs, he said, but we were quite excited that the trick with the freezer worked so well. The German research group is now working on defenses against the attack that will ensure encryption keys are never put into vulnerable memory chips. Instead, they are only used in memory directly attached to a phone's processor. So the whole trick they did with freezing the RAM, they figured out they can do the same thing with your cell phone.
That's amazing.
That's, yeah, really.
So, will it work better if you use like liquid nitrogen?
Probably. Well, I mean, it works on the concept
lowest temperature
that a frozen,
these things will work with.
Well, it works on the concept that the colder a memory chip is, the longer it takes what was written in that RAM chip to drain out when you remove the power. Generally, like on your desktop PC, unless the chips are really cold, like you're running the thing outside, it's like a second or two, and everything's gone. But, yeah. You know, if you're running a thing outside in the winter and you got a really good cooling system, you know, you might get that time up to 5 or even maybe 6 seconds. you know, you're essentially waiting on the static to discharge out of the thing, right? And they figured out if you cool it down, the chip holds on to what was in it longer, so you can still turn it on or read it. Outside of whatever wrote it in there. So it's a way of getting encryption keys out of memory. And
that's, man. I always thought that stuff discharged, like you said, like within a second instant.
Well, it normally does because, you know, at room temperature.
Yeah.
But you've really got to freeze these things. They were getting it down to negative 10 C to slow it down enough for them to boot their custom software and read it. So the moral of the story is don't let somebody take your phone and put it in the freezer. But, yeah. But most of your Android handsets aren't even using the disk encryption anyway, so all you got to do is hook the thing up as a USB device and dump it. Or use the debugging feature, which you can just turn on by going to the menu. So, and a lot of people turn on the debugging features anyways because they'll want run an app that wants it.
Yeah.
So you won't even have to turn it on. You just hook the phone up via USB. You can usually dump it out anyways. Or just yank the SD card out, right? So, yeah, just don't lose track of your phone. You won't have this problem.
Pretty much.
This next one up is from The Verge. The lock screen on your phone may not be doing a good job of keeping intruders out. A new bug has been found on the Galaxy S3 that allows users to bypass the lock screen and access all the phone's functions. And we've just confirmed its efficacy. I can't say that word. I know the word, I just can't seem to spit it out. We just tested its effectiveness on a Sprint version of the device running Android 4.1.1. To get in, one needs only to click the emergency call button followed by the emergency contacts. Once there, if one clicks the physical home button followed quickly by the power button, the lock screen will disappear and when you wake the phone again. So there's a memory loop where you can get it out of that and dump you to the home screen. It requires a bit of timing, but we were able to successfully reproduce the bug, which was first discovered by Sean McMillan, without much difficulty. After bypassing the lock screen using the bug, it remained disabled until the phone was rebooted. Oh, wow. The security offered by the lock screen has been challenged before, with users finding bugs in systems like the one recently found in iOS 6.1, which also leveraged the emergency dialer. And apparently Verge reached out to Samsung and hasn't gotten a response yet. So, remember that story we did a couple of weeks ago about how the police couldn't search your phone if you had a lock screen on it? Does that count right. If they know how to get around it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, don't trust the lock screen on your phone to just casual use. Just never let it out of your sight. Duct tape it to the side of your head.
Oh, yeah, and a lock screen's never been a big piece of security anyways. You know, you can just hook it up to a computer and get the data.
Usually.
You know, that's interesting because, like, when I had first read about this, the bug only allowed you to, like, very momentarily glimpse the screen, and, like, it was barely enough time to even, like, click an icon or anything like that. And it wasn't just. I would be impressed if anybody could actually manage to interact with the device with that quick flash. Because I actually managed to reproduce that one specific bug. But I haven't actually seen the one where it actually completely disabled the lock screen until the phone was rebooted.
Well, it sounds like it's specific to Android 4.1.1, so that's the other thing, right? Is, I mean, how many different versions of Android are floating around out there?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, but while we're on the subject of funny bugs, this next one up is from The Guardian. Microsoft has been fined 651 million euros by the European Commission for failing to give the users a choice of web browser when they logged into Windows computers in Europe between May 2011 and July 2012, breaking a binding commitment it had made in 2009. The error arose when Microsoft's own programmers forgot to include a single line of code that would have automatically triggered the browser choice program on versions of Windows 7 running its first major update called Service Pack 1. A source close to Microsoft explained it was a single line of code that triggered the browser choice program. So they left the line out of autoexec.bat. Actually, truthfully, it was probably commented out when somebody was testing something and it just shipped with the comment in place.
Right.
It had a list of versions of Windows to test against. If the version was found in that list, the program would run. They didn't include Service Pack 1. Oh, okay, I see. So it wasn't even that. It was just testing your Windows version to see if it should run, which is effectively a different version of Windows in that list. So they were checking version numbers, and they forgot to update the list. This meant that an estimated 15 million users were not presented with the alternatives, such as Google's Chrome, Mozilla Firefox, Apple Safari, Opera, or other browsers. Horror of horrors, because it's so hard to go download another browser. The fine works out to about 37.40 euros per user affected, or more than 1.3 million per day.
Wow.
God. So,
why aren't they suing, like, Apple for this, who releases their shit with one browser?
Because Microsoft
Apple only has,
is
like, what is it,
boy?
Like 15% of the market share?
This is the European Union wants money, and they found a way to milk it out of a company.
Yeah, for what Apple charges for their shit, they should be able to get money out of that.
Yeah. I think, isn't this all left over from, like, laws that they had put in place cases when Microsoft was, like, becoming a monopoly?
This is left over from the EU settlement when IE 6 and 7 were, like, the browsers.
Right. To be fair, it's a valid point. Like, enforcing them to actually give options, considering, like, you know, at this point in time, like, pretty much anybody with a computer is running Windows. And when you, like, force your products on them, odds are they're not going to go with anything else.
Well,
but
I don't agree
with that.
All of a
sudden, there's no competition in any way whatsoever with these other browsers. Because, like, yeah, sure, people like you or me who actually know what we're doing, it's not a problem to go get another browser. Most people just have no idea.
I just want to run this past you here. I'm playing a little devil's advocate. By that logic, should you make Chrysler put Fords and Mustangs in their showrooms?
Well, no, because they don't have a monopoly.
You could argue Microsoft doesn't have a monopoly. Apple and Linux exists.
They exist, but if you actually look at the market saturation, Microsoft has a monopoly. You know, like, yeah, Apple's got a little bit of it, but it's
you've been too successful, so fuck you.
That's kind of what they did with AT&T back in the day.
That's true.
You have to have some of these checks and balances in there, because once you reach a certain point of market saturation, it's almost impossible to compete with you, because you're able to do it for so much less than your competitors. Just because you have, like, so much more income and everything like that.
Okay,
your
how many
costs
people
aren't gonna
do
be as high.
Actually use Internet Explorer?
I know a couple.
I don't know anybody.
Your mom doesn't count.
They're all Luddites.
Grandmother uses Chrome, okay?
Fair enough.
And I didn't put her up to that one. I was surprised as hell when I sat down on her machine. That was the browser.
Fair enough.
I put Firefox on there. So, I mean, it's almost a non-issue, if you ask me. I mean, today. Anybody is...
Well, no, like, it is for the most part today.
Chrome was putting, like, TV ads out there, for God's sake. I mean...
But, it was definitely an issue, and that's what I was saying. It was like, you know, like, that's what this ruling is from. It's from back when Microsoft was having total monopoly on browsers. It might be time to reassess those laws that they enacted, but there's definitely a reason for them at the time.
Well, I mean, I have no major love for Microsoft. I'm sure everybody kind of knows that one. But I don't much care for a government saying, no, you have to include these options in your software. Because how long is that even relevant? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know how slowly governments move on anything.
Oh, absolutely.
So
They move pretty quick when you throw some money at them.
Well, that's true. But I don't like governments telling anybody what they have to do. I mean, I can see them saying what not to do, but it's like, oh no, you have to include options. You have to let people pick browsers other than yours. I mean, I could certainly see them saying you can't prevent them from going and downloading Chrome, but, you know, forcing Microsoft to present, you know, yes, here's our browser and here's all of our competitors.
That's the thing, though. It's not. They're not telling them what they can do, can or can't do with Windows. It's the bundled
They're
software.
Finding them right here for not doing what they wanted. For a
Well, yeah, but it's more about the bundled software. Like, it's not necessarily about Windows itself. It's just, you know, because, like, they're selling Windows. They're not selling Internet Explorer. But, you know, it's like, I don't know.
Well, anyways, let's see. back to the story here, but Microsoft could have been fined as much as 10% of its fiscal 2012 revenues, equivalent to 5.9 billion euros. The fine on Wednesday, though large, is substantially less than that. So in other words, the EU wasn't trying to get Microsoft to just say, fuck it, and walk. Because I wouldn't have blamed them one bit. It's like, yeah, we're just going to pull out of Europe. If you want Windows, you can import it. The two sides have been giving varying estimates of the time and number of users affected. Microsoft suggested it was 28 million people between February 2011 and July 2012. The European Commission, when announcing the fine, put it at 15 million and with the starting date of May 2011. So it sounded like they should have went with the EU's numbers as opposed to... Anyways... So Microsoft made a five-year commitment in 2009 to offer users a choice of different browsers after the European Commission's Compendium Commission determined that the combination of its dominance in the desktop, where Windows runs around 95% of machines, it gave the pre-installed Internet Explorer browser an unfair advantage over rivals. At the time that the negotiations first began in the early 2000s, IE had a share of over 80% among browsers. The commission implemented the browser – so there is a limit on there of 5 years, so that helps a little bit. Let's see. The commission had implemented the browser choice system to create a level playing field because, you know, that's – yeah, never mind. And said that once in use, it was very effective. The choice screen was very successful with users. Jacqueline Almuna – the Compendium Commissioner said in a statement. For example, until November 2010, 84 million browsers were downloaded through it. So how did this guy get the stats? I guess Microsoft must be publishing them. It was Microsoft itself which realized it was not complying with the directive after the release of SP1, a major update to Windows 7 in February 2011. On discovering the error in July 2012, it got in touch with EC's Compendium arm to admit the error. Oh, so Microsoft came clean and the EC was like, yep, give us the fucking cash. The penalty is the first time that the EC has ever had to fine a company for failing to comply with the so-called comments or commitments decision. Well, it doesn't even sound like the error was on purpose. It sounds like it was a bug.
Yeah. You know, Microsoft probably should have gotten away with just, you know, quietly patching the system so it didn't happen anymore and just, like, not telling anyone.
Yeah. The size of the fine had been calculated by considering the gravity and the duration of the need to ensure a deterrent effect of the fine, and as mitigating circumstance, the fact that Microsoft has cooperated with the commission and provided information which helped the commission investigate the matter effectively. So, I understand them coming clean, because if they didn't, and then somebody came back after the fact and was able to prove that it wasn't showing them the screen...
Fair enough.
Yeah, that would have been a problem. So I understand the whole coming clean thing, but that's a very expensive bug.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Very expensive.
Oh yeah. So,
on the other hand, though, this is an interesting precedent. This is a software company being forced to pay for a bug, a lot of money for a bug.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And yeah, but this bug caused their software to violate already established laws.
Well, law might be a strong word. It sounds more like an agreement, but it's almost contract law. But I kind of wonder about that, though, if you could use that as a lever. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, see, your software, Adobe, Oracle, is really vulnerable to all these problems. And Microsoft just had to pay a shit ton of money for a bug in their software, and all that did was, you know, not tell people that Google Chrome existed.
I question more, well, is it a law or isn't it a law? If it's not a law, then they don't have to pay.
Well, it's an agreement they made with the EU, so they're going to pay. I mean,
well, if they don't pay, then they can't sell their software there, right? So it's kind of like, to me, that's pretty much a law. Like... Yeah, a law is a set of rules determined by a governing body.
Well, no, I can see that. It's just, I mean, I don't think that it went through a formal... You know, honestly, I don't know what the EU's process for... I don't know that the EU even passes laws. I would think that would be done by the member states, but I don't know what their process is.
No, it's probably something like they come to, you know, they probably have like a committee or something like that that comes up with these, and then it gets filtered down, then everybody follows it or something like that.
But the reason I say I'm not sure that it's a law, I'm thinking in technicalities here. Like in the States, if the FCC decides the regulation is X, that's not a law, that's an FCC regulation. Now,
right.
You still kind of have to comply with it as though it's a law because of the law that gives the FCC the, you know, the right to exist.
Yeah.
But you know, that's not a law. That's something different.
All right.
Whereas
well,
a law is something
way.
That's you
like,
know, been through both houses of Congress and signed by the president. So,
but, you know, like regulation, that's perfect terminology. You know, it definitely is more applicable than a law. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But either way, if you have a piece of software that violates regulations, then, you know, you're going to have to be held accountable for that.
I'm not saying you're not. I'm just...
It's probably not even a precedent. This sort of thing's probably happened in the past. Maybe not in this sort of specific example of, like, forcing somebody to have software, but I'm sure there's been software in the past that have violated regulations of some kind, and they've been penalized for it.
I don't know. This is the first one I've known about that somebody's actually had to pay a big-ass fine for it. Usually it's just you fix it and move on with life. But I just think it's interesting because if you could use it as a lever, it's like, yeah, next time you have this operating system that's horribly easy to hack into, just, you know, hey, you could actually hold the company that wrote it accountable. Might be a way to get some more secure software out there. So
yeah, people have been dreaming that for...
Yeah, I know. But anyways... Let's move on to the next one here, because Suave and I are not going to agree on how things should be governed. So let's see. This one's from CNET. Somehow, Nicholas Weber found himself in an IT class while in jail. I should point out, like, 15 people sent me this story. Nicholas Weber found himself in an IT class while in jail. He's serving 5 years for creating a site called Ghost Market, which allowed those interested in creating computer viruses, partaking of stolen identities, and enjoying private credit card data to congregate. He was caught using hacked personal information to buy everything from iPods to luxury hotel stays. One might have thought that an IT class would have been quite dull for him. One might have also thought that inviting him to an IT class might encourage him to enjoy a little mischief. As the Daily Mail reports, mischief did indeed occur. So much so that the computer system at Her Majesty's prison ISIS, South London, the Queen's name adorns so many English, okay, whatever. Anyways, the computer system at the prison was hacked. This slightly peculiar miscalculation that led to the hacking, which happened in 2011, has come to light because the teacher running the IT class is suing the college that employed him for unfair dismissal. Michael Fox claims he didn't know Weber was a hacker. The prison banned him. Other prisons were sent a note that his talents were allegedly imperfect. So in other words, this guy says he got blackballed because somebody put this guy who was arrested for hacking in his class. And, of course, you know, nature took its course. So other prisons sent a note that his talents were allegedly imperfect. Kensington and Chelsea College laid him off. So... a spokesman for the prison told the Mail, at the time of this incident in 2011, the educational computer system at HMP, ISIS, was a closed network. No access to personal information or wider access to the internet or other prison systems would have been possible, as far as they know. The Mail, however, suggests that a major panic ensued. Indeed, Fox told the Employment Tribunal on Friday, the perceived problem was that there was a tutor who had been excluded by the prison and charged with allowing a hacking expert to hack into the prison's mainframe. Surely someone must have known Weber was a hacker before he went to the IT class. He's sometimes referred to as a notorious cyber criminal. If it wasn't Fox, who might have been? If not, it's not as if Weber could have hacked his way into getting an invite to the class, is it? ISIS specializes in prisoners under 25. It is situated next to Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh, and it's described as a maximum security facility. So to summarize, there was a guy who went to prison for hacking, and they were offering an IT class in the prisons, you know, I guess retraining so people could get a job when they got out of prison. And somebody let the hacker into the IT class, and the guy who taught the class got fired for it, and now he's suing.
So the hacker didn't even do anything. That we know
of. Yeah, it sounds like he was just exploring the network. But because it scared the shit out of the prison officials, this guy got blackballed and laid off. And, you know, the hacker probably got an extra month put on his stay or whatever. But
now, to be fair, it was definitely a lapse of judgment on this guy's part to let this guy who's in jail for hacking onto their network. But yeah, I feel like this is a bit of an overreaction.
Well, I'm wondering who made that decision. I'm, you know, involved in an education system as I am. I know a lot of times, you know, the people who are doing the teaching have no idea who's showing up until the first day of class.
Yeah, that very well could be. He maybe legitimately didn't know.
Well, he probably didn't even make the schedule. Somebody else probably did that.
Yeah.
You know, and approved people for it. But I don't know. I found that hilarious. Like, yep, let's give somebody who went to prison for hacking access to a computer and see what happens. So, let's see. Next
hey,
story
man,
up.
That's stereotyping. You can't do that. Just because he's a hacker doesn't mean he's going to hack.
Just because he has a beard and, you know, these strange cylinders wrapped around his chest. Anyways, I'm going to stop that before I get myself in trouble. It's not IHN, damn it. Let's see. I completely lost my place. Am I on the Torrent Freak story? I think I'm on the Torrent Freak story. Oh, okay. This one's funny because it was written in Time and then updated later. From Torrent Freak. Last week, the Swedish Pirate Party was forced to shut down its routing services to the Pirate Bay. The party and its leaders took this difficult decision after they were threatened with a lawsuit by a local anti-piracy group. In other words, they hounded them until they finally shut it down. Luckily for the Pirate Bay, the pirate parties of Norway and Cataluna were willing to take over the role. However, just after just a few days, the Norwegians had to shut down their Pirate Bay node as well, facing similar threats as their Swedish comrades. This resulted in some downtime earlier today, and I'm not actually sure when the story was written earlier this week, after which the Pirate Bay returned online from a rather unexpected location. A Pirate Bay insider informs Storm Freak that they had been working for a while to get connectivity inside North Korea, and today they made the big switch. We've been in talks with them for about 2 weeks since they opened access to foreigners to use 3G in the country, a Pirate Bay insider told us. The Pirate Bay has been invited just like Eric Schmidt and Dennis Rodman. We've declined up until now. No comments on that yet, really? Pirate Bay operating outside of North Korea?
You know, Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you saw the follow-up story, right?
I know we saw that. I'm getting to that.
Okay.
It's just, this thing's really well written, really well written, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, so I was under the impression they just sent like some random black guy and told him it was Obama.
Oh, God. That might work. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead a bit. Yeah, they're not actually routing through North Korea. They're not hosted out of North Korea. They made it look like they're routing through North Korea. They're probably actually routing out of Cambodia. But, and apparently the Norwegian Pirate Party never actually routed any traffic. They just put their name on the node, and that was enough to get people to pull their connectivity. But yeah, it's they're not actually hosted at North Korea, but for several days, a lot of people thought they were. So, and there's a lot of really funny statements about North Korea letting the Pirate Party go. It's like, yeah, one of the more totalitarian governments in the world is going to help free speech everywhere else. What?
Yeah.
Not likely. Also, yeah, like, I feel like the internet infrastructure in North Korea just isn't there.
Well, you know,
Probably a good assumption.
Yeah. If you think about it, North Korea is putting all their money into trying to launch a nuke at either South Korea or us right now.
I think there's
literally, feeding their people.
I think there's literally only something like 5,000 people in North Korea with full internet access.
And I'm sure every single one of them is on a list.
That's intranet access.
Yeah. No, that's internet access. Everybody else has access to, you know, the party approved intranet. It's the actual outside access that's really rare.
Yeah. So, and final story to close out decking tonight. This is also from The Verge. Popular note-taking service Evernote had to reset all of its user passwords after information including usernames, email addresses, and encrypted passwords was stolen in a security breach. A warning on the service's official blog, which was experiencing load problems soon after being posted, emphasized that no content was either accessed, changed, or lost, but advises users they will be prompted to choose a new password next time they log in, and provides advice on selecting a secure word or phrase. The passwords taken in the breach were both hashed and salted, meaning that they should be protected from all but the most dedicated cracking attempts, but the blog post does not explain which encryption algorithm was used. So, yeah, we didn't use triple Dez, it was just Dez, and the salt was, you know, somebody's first name.
Don't look at the man behind the curtain, just go reset your password.
According to an email from Evernote, unusual and potentially malicious activity was first detected by the company's security team on February 28th. Evernote plans to release updates to its native apps for various platforms over the next several hours in an attempt to smooth out the password reset process for all users. So, Evernote got popped. If you use your Evernote password anywhere else, you probably ought to go change that, like, everywhere now. And, you know, this is something I kind of wonder about note-taking in the cloud, because if you think about what ends up in people's notes...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, school notes, yeah, sure, who cares? But if you're talking like business meeting notes, the kind of espionage you can pull getting into something like that, yeah.
Once again, your stuff in the cloud, you really got to think about what's there and live with it or live without it and letting other people see it, I think.
You want a really good example. Yeah, if you want a really good example of... you know, running shit in the cloud, just go look at the current SimCity game. That's working real well for them. Yeah. Actually, Diablo 3 had that same problem when they first launched, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah.
But, you know, like, it would almost be more interesting to get access to everybody's notes that they've taken online versus, like, even their inbox. Because, like, the types of things people save and things like that, like, easily there's tons of people who'd, like, save all their passwords on there so they don't forget. Or, I don't want to forget my banking password. I better put that on there, too.
Well, think about it in terms of corporate espionage. How many engineers do you think are keeping their design notes in the thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. All sorts of intellectual property, probably.
So, yeah, I was never I've played with Evernote before, but I was never really comfortable with it because it was always kind of gimmicky to me.
Well, you know, I like the concept because, you know, like I'm always looking for a good way to like, you know, I'm always looking for links and stuff like that for stories. And when I stumble across it on my phone, I like the ability to like have something where I can, you know, save that link and then have it shared to my computer very easily. But I found that I had installed Evernote, but I found it to be way too invasive. Like, it just kind of like gets its fingers into all parts of your system and it just like,
oh yeah, it like wants your photos, contacts, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh yeah, like it's just too bloated, you know. Like I like the idea of shared notes, but not Evernote, they're garbage.
So you know, you'd almost be better off using something like a Dropbox and TrueCrypt to or some other encryption format that you can
I'm not even worried about losing those notes. Like they're just links for stories. You know, but that's really all I use Notes for.
Google Docs for that.
Yeah.
So. And I just noticed I'm not an admin in the IRC chat room anymore. I was skimming that to make sure I didn't miss anything before we closed out the show here. So, looks like we had a net split. Yay! Anyways, of course, listen to the stream. We're always updating, and I think Big just added a whole bunch of new music. Sard just implemented some backup routines on the broadcast box, so I think we were working on fixing some of the clock whiz. Did we fix the problem with the old episodes of Pure Decking, like it playing the same one over and over again?
No, I completely forgot about that. I should work on that.
Not to call you out on the air or anything. I thought you'd said that was fixed, so oops. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all good.
Of course, Pure Decking every Thursday, and apparently the same old episode of Pure Decking right after that.
All right.
Woohoo! Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. I think, is Big back on hiatus with that? I don't know if he did one yesterday or not.
I don't know.
Don't think so.
The last thing I saw recorded on the box was the last IHN, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he did.
Yeah. NR7 whenever, hit up the Galaxy 15 site, the Twitter handle, the feedback form, the shout box, the subreddit, and the IRC. And did I miss any ways to get a hold of us? Smoke signals. We might respond to smoke signals. You'll need to get the fire big enough so that Suave can see it from Canada. So good luck. And I think that's all I've got. I'm getting ready to hit the play button on this music unless anybody else has anything before we close it out. I'll take that silence as a note.